Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. Alpine. It's an email client, not a Linux distribution. Well, it is a Linux distribution, but in this context, it's an email client. The next one in the list is Alpine 2.25. This is a project that is the openly licensed version of, or re-implementation of, the Pine email client. Pine was developed by, I don't know, Washington University or something, which is also the same body that developed Pico, which was a text editor, which was later re-implemented by GNU in the form of Nano. So if you know the Nano text editor, then you kind of know Pico. And if you know the Alpine email client, then you kind of know Pine. You might think that because of the shared sort of origin story that Alpine and Nano might therefore share some similarities, and you'd be wrong. Like, I mean, they're developed by different projects. The Alpine is not a GNU project, Nano is. So there's that. I don't know, I've never used Pico or Pine, so I don't know whether they were similar. I'm just warning you, because when I first opened Alpine, I thought, well, no, I should say, when I opened Alpine while researching for this episode. The first time I opened Alpine was ages ago, when I was new to Linux and I was just exploring, and I found Alpine and it was really cool and I used it and it was pretty simple. But I was so fresh to just the concept of running something in a terminal that I didn't know, I had no expectations. Fast forward 10 years, it's been longer than 10 years. Why do I keep saying I've only been using Linux for 10 years? Fast forward almost 20 years, and I've got expectations. I've used GNU Nano. So if you present me now with an interface that looks like GNU Nano, with all the little menu options down at the bottom and sort of a big blank space in the middle and a little title bar at the top, then I'm going to expect it to work like Nano. And I'm just warning you that if that's also you, with variance allowed for how many years we've fast-forwarded since you've done such and such, been using Linux, then you might find Alpine a little bit jarring or grating. Like, it's going to be a little bit confusing. And frankly, I would go so far as to say that Alpine, hoping for consistency within Alpine itself, will confound you. Like, that is not something that you are going to get from Alpine. There, just sometimes you'll be pressing this key to do this action, and then on the next screen, it's that same key for a completely different action, even though on every other screen, that key did the original action. It is so confusing. You have to read what is in front of you. I can't emphasize how many times I got lost or triggered something that I didn't mean to trigger for that reason. It is absolutely inconsistent. So just, it is consistent in that its menu is ever changing. Like, every screen, different menu, different hotkeys for actions that may have had a completely different key assigned to it in the previous screen. So just be aware of that before you start. Now, when you do start Alpine, and that's what I'll talk about here, is just kind of how to configure it. From there, it's really, really obvious. But when you first start Alpine for the very first time, you get a screen that sort of introduces you to the project insofar as it says, hey, this is like Pine, except openly licensed. Press E to get out of here. So you press E, and that's the only time you'll ever see that screen. From now on, you'll always end up at the main screen of Alpine when you start Alpine. So that's what we'll call the main menu, because I think, quite possibly, that might be what they called it. I could be wrong. And if I could get back to that screen, yeah, they do. They call it main menu up at the top, the title bar. Okay, so the main menu has entries like help and compose message and message index, which is a fancy way of saying an inbox, essentially, but there's a subtle difference. Folder list, address book, setup, and quit. Okay, so That's like a little scroll menu that you just arrow up and down through. Or you can use the hotkeys presented by the name or in the little menu down at the bottom. So if you're just getting started with Alpine, which I'm at this stage, I'm kind of assuming that's the case, you need to configure Alpine. And this is the most complex part of using Alpine. I think it's the most complex part of using any email client. It is probably one of the main reasons people don't use email clients all that much anymore. People just go to the website of their email provider. It's kind of a low-level nightmare to get this stuff configured. And it is not helped by the fact that so many different providers of email have their own special protocols and their own exceptions to established protocols. And so you can't even rely, even if you look into like, okay, I'm going to learn how to do this email thing once and for all. Well, everything you've learned is probably wrong once you go over to, I don't know, Gmail, because everything's different there. Or Microsoft Exchange, because they're not even using the standard protocols and so on. So, or whatever it's called, Microsoft Outlook, I guess, but that uses Exchange, right? So, I mean, the point is that everyone seems to have their own special method of doing this, and I can only assume that this is a way to discourage people from using email clients, because they want you to come to their site, I guess. I don't know why. I don't know how that stuff works. I don't know why anyone would care. It is complex. Make no mistake about it. This is not an easy process, and I can't really describe it accurately because there are so many variables. Like, it just depends on what emails server you're trying to use. But what I can say is that there are two separate places in Alpine where you need to configure your settings. So both of them start in the settings menu, which is the S key from the main menu. You go into S for settings, and then you've got two locations to deal with. I guess the logical place to start is with the collection list. And that's not necessarily the one that you would think you would start with. You'd probably think you would press C for config, but no. In this case, that's not what you want. You want a collection list, which is L. So L takes you to a list of folders that Alpine has automatically generated for you. And right now, there's just the one. It's nicknamed Mail, M-A-I-L. So if you hit return on mail, then you can reset the nickname to something different. For instance, like if you're using Forward Email Service, then that's forwardemail.net, which is quite a good little service. Then you put that in there. Or if you're using Gmail, for instance, which a lot of people do, just call it Gmail, or you know, whatever you want to nickname it. This is just a nickname for this collection list. The next entry in this is server, and this is where the complexity begins. So the server, you might think, is I don't know gmail.com or whatever. Well, no, not probably not. You need to go to your email provider, whether it's forwardemail.net or gmail.com or outlook.com or Proton Mail or proton.me or whatever the address for that is, Fast Mail, you know, whatever service you're using, you need to kind of go there and find out from that provider how to remotely access your account. And like I say, all of them do it a little bit differently. And that can be that's the most complex part of this, is navigating the unique format that they provide for remote access. And sometimes it's an option that you have to activate. Like in Gmail, you have to go into your settings, and you have to go to sort of like POP and IMAP settings or something, and then turn that on, because otherwise they just don't allow it. They just don't let you have access outside of a web browser. And they do warn you that it's, you know, that you're doing a thing that could compromise your privacy and your account security, and do you really want to do this? And you have to say yes. And I believe, if memory serves, and I could be wrong about this, but I believe for Gmail, had to do this at a job once, you have to turn on like a recovery code if you're using two-factor authentication, which I think Gmail pretty much enforces now. Then you have to like get a special code that basically bypasses the two-factor authentication. And you'll see this in other applications too, where Yeah, normally they use 2FA, but because you're essentially, you're setting up a non-interactive session between two applications. So you essentially need an API key, is basically what it is. And so they'll give you a big long string that you'll never remember, so you'll have to copy and paste it. So you'll copy that API key or recovery code or whatever they call it, copy that and paste it into some text document on your computer for a moment, or just in your clipboard if you trust yourself to keep it in your clipboard. And so you've got that now. You got that saved. And you've got, so more importantly, I guess, or as importantly, you get the actual server URL that email provider wants you to go to check your mail. So for Gmail, well, for probably all of these services, you would want the IMAP option, because if you use the POP3 option, then you're always working with a copy of your email. You're looking at your server, the email server, and you're grabbing a copy of all the messages. That sounds fine, and it is fine. You can do it that way. But then if you delete a message off of your out of Alpine, then you haven't deleted the message from your email server. You've just deleted your copy of that message. That's probably not what you want. Because, I mean, then tomorrow when you log in, you know, through the web to check your email, like, those messages will still be there, and you'll be confused as to why that would be. Well, that's because you only deleted a copy of them from your local machine. So what you really probably are looking to do is using the IMAP protocol. And there's a, again, for each different service, there's going to be some kind of different format and different URL. So you grab the URL that the email service provider gives you, and copy that. And now if you've copied your API key or your recovery code or whatever, you've just copied over it potentially, unless you've got a clipboard manager that remembers lots of things at the same time. So copy that URL and paste that into the server field. So now you've got a nickname for your collection, you've got the correct server, and after you save that, and of course, like I say, there's no consistency in this interface. So for this screen, you hit Control X to exit and save. That might not be true for another screen, so don't grasp onto that too tightly. Just for this, for now, you're gonna hit Control X. So you hit Control X to save your SMTP setting, and you are prompted for the password. And that, assuming that you're using a server that insists upon two-factor authentication, this password is probably not your normal password, because your normal password is only part of, usually, a part of what you need to do to get into that email service, right? You usually have to type in your password, and then you get a request for an authentication key or a token or something. You know, something, you know, you go onto your phone and you go to that one app, whatever you use, whether it's, you know, Google Authentication or what's the other one that I have here for another thing. I forget who makes this, VeriSign. VIP access or something, I don't know. Or just free TOTP, which is what I generally use when I can. Or free OTP, sorry, plus. You go there, you press your little key, and you get a 6-digit code. And you type in that 6-digit code, and then you're in your email server. You can't do that here. This Alpine wants to do this all on its own. So you need that special recovery code that your email server probably provides you, and you paste that in. So you're not logging in two-factor authentication through Alpine. You're trusting that your computer is protected against people who might want to get in and look at your passwords. So just kind of bear that in mind. This is not two-factor authentication. This is overriding that, because it's communication between one application and another, and it's not an interactive session. It's just, I mean, it is interactive, but this component, the signing in, the logging in to your server to check for new messages, that's automated. You're not going to get a prompt for a two-factor token. Okay, so you enter your password, and you press Y to, after it tells you that it's you know, that it can contact your server and so on, you can press Y to exit and save your changes. All right, so now you've got presumably everything configured to check email, but you still don't have permission to send email. So you press E to exit. Remember how I said in the earlier screen it's Control X? Well, on this screen it's E to exit. And don't get used to that because there's another screen, which we might not get to. I forget where it is, but there is another screen that it's not E to exit. It's M for main menu. So anyway, E to exit today on this screen. And now you need to enter the SMTP information to be able to contact your email server when you're sending messages out. So for that, you do press C from this, you're still in the setup menu, so you go to C for config, or configuration rather, and then you enter the setup configuration screen. Here you put in your name. Well, actually you don't have to put in a name, but you might want to. It's auto-filled with whatever your username is on your computer, on Linux. So you can put a new value there, or you can just leave it as your username. Your user domain you can enter, but again, it doesn't actually matter under these circumstances. What you're actually doing is going down to the SMTP server field, and it says for sending, and you're putting in, again, whatever URL your email service provider has provided you for that remote access. And again, you might have to really dig around for this, because a lot of these services don't want you to ever do that. They just aren't interested in that. Now, you might have your own server account, like your own virtual private server or whatever. And a lot of times they have email services as well that you can relay through. So it could just be SMTP. myGreatHost.example.com, whatever. So like, who knows what it'll be, or it could be something really, really over complex. Like the Gmail one would be like smtb.gmail.com:587/TLS/user=yourusername@gmail.com. And, you know, kind of really long and convoluted encoded sort of, message within a URL type situation. So you just have to learn, you have to find that out from your provider and enter it into the SMTP field. Your inbox path, you may want to, or you do need to set that to curly brace, and then for you know, the URL for your IMAP URL, close curly brace, and then inbox, all capital, INBOX. And that'll be your inbox for your IMAP data. And Alpine creates that on its own. It doesn't fill the field out, I don't think, but it does create the folder. And then you press E to save and exit that configuration. And then you want to quit Alpine, so that's Q to quit. And then you can relaunch Alpine and go to compose, for C for compose message, and send an email from your Alpine account. Now, of course, again, you're not really sending it from, like, Alpine. You're sending it, you're preparing a message locally, and then you're telling Alpine to handle that message. And handling that message means it's going to contact your SMTP server, provide whatever authentication that requires, and then that server will send your email to whatever account you've specified. And that's it. That's Alpine. That's configuring Alpine. From there, it's pretty straightforward. There's I for your message in index, which is basically your inbox, and there's C for composing a message. I mean, I don't know what else there is aside from that, really. And that's Alpine, and it's cool. It is really, really satisfying to use email in a terminal, because in theory, like, that's just kind of all you need, right? I mean, it's just not that big of a deal. I have had a pretty robust Mutt configuration. I don't use Alpine in real life, but I was using Mutt for a very long time, and I've kind of gotten away from Mutt even, because as email becomes just stupider and stupider, trying to keep up with it, like trying to keep up to make a terminal interface kind of viable, it becomes more and more complex, and it gets more, you just spend so much time on it. And if you really, really want that, then that's fine. But at some point, I think I finally just decided that I'm not that invested in where I consume email to really bother. And that's a pity. I mean, and I do think that, yeah, email has become, I mean, there's just so much HTML email out there. And a lot of times, amazingly, it just doesn't work. You know, I mean, you can view the HTML and you can try to figure out which link is the thing that they're telling you to click on and what do you need to do to do the thing that they're asking you to do or to see the message that they actually want you to see. And you might think, well, I just won't subscribe to things that send out HTML emails, which is fine. You can do that. But on the other hand, like, there are things out there that you might actually want in your inbox and you subscribe to them, but they just don't send plain text versions. Contact, I think, strikes a pretty good balance of that. You can set KMail Contact to ingest, you know, plain text, to present HTML without loading the files and stuff, you know, any remote content. But then when it is an HTML thing, you can click a button there in your interface to render the HTML. And then if that seems okay to you, but you want more, you could even click the button that says, yes, load the remote content. So I feel like KMail does a really good job of kind of mitigating like how much of an email you have to see before you sort of consciously agree to let all of that email onto your system. And Mutt, like, and Alpine, you know, I mean, these interfaces, I mean, yeah, it is the fluidity between, well, I'm not sure I want to see everything yet. And then once you say to yourself, okay, well, now, yeah, actually, this is a message I'm interested in. I would like to see the whole thing. Well, because it's in a terminal, like, now you have to kind of, suddenly it's not just a click anymore. Then you have to decide how do you want to get to that content. Do you want to open it up in some other application? Do you want to like render the HTML somewhere else? Like how do you get to see what you signed up to see? Who knows? For Mutt, there's a bunch of piping that you can do, and I imagine there's probably options in Alpine as well. You could say, take any HTML that comes in and convert it to Markdown, or take the HTML, pipe it through this filter application, and just give me a list of all the URLs down at the bottom. You know, there are a lot of different options, and you can set an external a viewing application. You know, there are ways around all of these things, but it's manual configuration. It's making choices of what works for you best, and so on. And it can be a lot of work, unfortunately. And I think if you want to, if that's what you want to do, then I think it's totally worth it, because then you're getting something that you want. But if at the end of the day, you're just sort of interested in seeing email or not, then I think Alpine and Mutt are they're fine, but the world has moved on. That's my gut feeling. And I'm not trying to make a philosophical statement here. You know, I'm not trying to say like, oh, we all need to move on from text-based email, because I don't believe that's true. It's just that if you are using email to do its intended function, which is like to talk to the external, you know, to talk to other people, to communicate with other people, then you're likely going to find that a lot of people out there in the world are using email formats that are not ever intended for a text-only delivery, which, again, if I'm making a philosophical statement here, it's the opposite of what I'm admitting to. And I'm saying that really, I think we need to, I would really prefer for us to hold on to the text-based sort of purity of email, because that's its strength, but for lots of different reasons. I mean, not only for like your arbitrary choice of email client, but also for accessibility. So it's and parsability. It's really, really important. It's just, unfortunately, everyone else has decided that they're going to do something different. And yeah, you can parse it. You can set up filters to parse it differently and try to kind of decode what they're really trying to say through their over complex HTML messages. That does work. It's just, you might spend a lot more time sort of filtering through all the junk than you would if you just looked at the message. So anyway, that is Alpine. It's a very cool application. It makes email, like, once you've got it configured, and again, that's not Alpine's fault, that's just, that's the state of email now. Once you get it configured, very complex sort of process that might involve you setting things on the mail server and getting special codes and getting special URL formats and stuff like that. Once you have it all configured in Alpine, it's a beautiful thing to use. It's just so fluid, so easy to use as long as you read the menus. Do not rely on your muscle memory from Nano. That will not work. But you'll eventually develop muscle menu, obviously, for Alpine. And it's a great little interface. That's it. That's Alpine. That's a cool terminal-based email client. You should check it out. It is a lot of fun until you start using email from, like, you know, getting email from all over the place. Then it becomes a lot less fun. Okay, I've got listener feedback, and there's other stuff in this list. There's AutoFS, there's Biff plus ComSat. So let's go get a cup of coffee first, and we'll come back and cover those topics. Okay, we're back, and I know what you think I'm going to say. You think I'm going to say, oh, I've got Robert Harris coffee, and it's okay. And well, you're half right, but here's why. So this morning I had to run some errands, so I walked down to the shops, did everything that I needed to do, stopped by the Prospector Cafe on my way home, and got a Danish and a flat white. So then I walked home with my flat white, sipping it and eating my Danish, and when I arrived home, because it's not a very long walk from the house to the shops, I still had like half of a cup of this flat white. So I just took the Robert Harris coffee that I had in my mug and I'd left on my desk before going out on my errands, poured my flat white into it, and so now I've got half, you know, homebrew Robert Harris cheap coffee and half really good Prospector coffee, and it's a good cup of coffee, actually. This works. It worked fine. That worked out really, really nicely. And actually, I think if I weren't quite as lazy as I apparently am, I think probably what I would do for some of this, like, kind of just okay coffee that I've had lately, I think I should just steam some milk. It's kind of surprising what steamed milk does for an average cup of coffee, you know? It's like, this is okay coffee. Put steamed milk into it, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, this is like a cappuccino almost. And it's not that it's improved the taste of the coffee, obviously, but I think there's that flavor of steamed milk. You just associate it with better quality, so you suddenly think you've got, like, fancy coffee. So that's what I'm drinking this episode. I hope your coffee has a much less complex story behind it and that it is very good. Have some listener email here, and this is, or not listener email, sorry, listener feedback. It was actually delivered over Mastodon, and it's from Johnny. Johnny O. What a name. I mean, that's just so classic sounding, doesn't it? Johnny O. It's like, hey, Johnny, you know, from the 50s. So Johnny O says, thanks for the podcast. Good stuff. Appreciate the thorough rundown of everything. Particularly, thanks for the pro tip that running SSHD allows other machines to GUI in using SFTP //. Who knew? You mentioned having to convert FLAC files to WAV and then to Opus. I think a one-liner will do. FLAC-D, example.FLAC, -O, space, -, space, pipe, space, Opus Inc, that's OPUSENC for the Opus encoder, -output file.opus. And I mean, what a great tip. Thank you, Johnny O, for that. This is the right way to do this. And you know, I always forget about that little, I'll call it a hack, even though it's not a hack, but the dash at the end of a command to tell it, hey, I don't want you to put it out to a file. I just want you to send the information to standard out so that I can then intercept it with a pipe and pipe it into the input of some other command. And I think I forget about it because it's not something that you can do with every command. Like, not every command understands, does every command, ls dash dash and then dash. No, it doesn't do it. Yeah. So like ls dash. Yeah. So not every command knows how to output to dash. It's something that people have to allow for in the application. And so I think I do tend to forget it if I'm not thinking about it. And it's kind of funny because that's a common error that I make in programming too. I'll return a value from a function and then try to send that value into a function that doesn't want that kind of value, you know, like an int into a string or a string into an int or whatever. So it is not this is a known bug with the way that I think. And yeah, really great tip there on the fluidity of Flack into Opus. I think it wasn't Flack to Opus that I was struggling with, actually. I know that's what I said in the episode. I think it's actually the AAC converter. And I still haven't looked at my script, actually, to fix it. Because, you know, I mean, it's like, it's working right now, and it's just, do I want to fix it? Or do I just want to let it just keep working? I mean, I think deep down I want to fix it eventually. So I will fix this. I'll just rest easier knowing that my code is less bad. And it's a great tip. So thank you very much, Johnny O, for that. And then I got an email from Matthias. You know Matthias. He says, ls lists a directory's content in many different ways. The one thing is that it lists. So he's arguing, or he's saying that there is an argument for, and he may be arguing, he's saying that the ls command does one thing. It lists the contents of a directory. It just happens to list it in many different ways. And I think that is a completely valid argument. Maybe ls wasn't the best example to use. Maybe it was. I think in context of the conversation, comparing ls to NetPBM. I think if someone had programmed a NetPBM converter that just goes from net, let's call it PXM, you know, where X is a variable, from anything to some other format, I think people would probably make the same argument. I think you'd say, oh, you don't need 348 different binaries or whatever the number of binaries was, some big number. You don't need all, you know, 100 different commands because we have this converter that does one thing. It converts netp something m into some other format, you know? So I guess in a way that's my point. Like, you can look at like doing one thing well in a couple of different ways. You can define, I guess, the threshold or maybe the scope of the one thing. And then you can also define the part where it does it in different ways. It's tricky, I think. It is a bit tricky. And I see both sides of it. Like, I really do. I absolutely do. Especially after encountering NetPBM. Because honestly, like, 300 NetPBM converters is a bit much for me. I think that might be over my personal threshold. And I think I might just appreciate a converter that just does a bunch of different NetPBM NetPBM. I am all over the place with that acronym. Is it PBM? I don't know. Let's call it NetPBM. NetPBM to JPEG to PNG to everything else. Like, that's fine. That's one command for that would be suitable for me. Then again, if I was actually using all of those formats and I actually cared, would I want one thing or would I want many things? I don't know. So it's an ongoing conversation that we all have to have with ourselves, basically. I mean, that's what the episode was about, right? Is like, let's think about what doing one thing actually means. And I think it does. I think there's a lot of weird context that comes into play when you're thinking about that. And there's tolerances and there's just what you want to use the thing for. It's a complex issue. So, I mean, a lot of things in computing are complex issues. And while you might flippantly say, well, yeah, that counts as one thing. That's fine. That's close enough. That's the one thing. Other people are thinking, no, that's not one thing. That's like 20 things that you crammed into one application. And I still think at the end of the day, it comes down to kind of like the developer. It's still not like a a Boolean issue. It's not like, oh, I can only have two functions because, you know, the main and then the function that it calls, because that's the only way you can truly do one thing and do it well. I think the functions in a program are one of the guides of how many things are you really doing. But then even then, you have to look at those functions. What are they doing? Are they just modifying the one thing that your application does? Or are they like legitimately doing something else? And would it make more sense to have that in a separate executable, separate code base for maintaining purposes? Or is it just all the same and you can just stick it in here because it's not that much of trouble to maintain both in one file? I don't know. Who knows? And I think ultimately the developer is kind of the arbiter of, well, I mean, the developer is the arbiter of that because the developer is literally writing the code and maintaining it. But I'm saying on a philosophical level, I think the developer is kind of the arbiter of that until, of course, they're not. And suddenly it becomes apparent that, no, this is not the best way to do it from a usability perspective. And that's where the bigger conversation comes in, I guess. Okay, let's talk about whatever's next on the list, which I've already forgotten. Oh, yeah, it's AutoFS. This is a kernel-based auto mounter. I found the documentation for this to be a little bit confusing, a little bit not explicit enough about sort of its intended use case, or maybe too explicit. Point is, AutoFS, if you look at it, it talks a lot about, like all the docs, that it always uses NFS as the example. And I couldn't tell whether NFS was the only use case for this, or whether that's just the one that everyone at the time thought you were going to be using it for. And I'm still not really sure. I think in the end, AutoFS is most useful for NFS. And I think maybe it could work with something else, but maybe the argument against using it for something else would be nothing else needs it. I'm not 100% sure, and I've never set it up myself. I have set up NFS, but I don't think I knew about AutoFS, and so I didn't use it. I just used NFS as NFS. And apparently using NFS as NFS, I mean, no one really, I guess, shouldn't say nobody, but it has fallen out of common usage, I would say, in most places. NFS, for better or for worse, I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing. For me, certainly Samba kind of started to make more sense anyway, but NFS, it exists, and you can create an NFS volume, and if you're just managing, if your computer or system only has like one NFS mount or two to worry about, then I guess just using NFS as NFS is sufficient, not a big deal. But you got a lot of NFS going on, your computer doesn't really necessarily need access to all of those volumes all at once, or I should say, you probably don't need access to all those file systems all at once, and therefore your computer doesn't really need to like sort of keep track of them all. And AutoFS provides a way for you to configure your NFS mounts as kind of an on-demand mount point. AutoFS can, you tell AutoFS in auto.master/etc what mounts potentially should exist. And then when you access that NFS mount, then the AutoFS daemon steps in, mounts the NFS volume, makes sure that it's available to you when you need it. And then once you're finished with it, I guess, I don't know how it determines that, it shuts that off. So that's it seems like a very cool feature. I can imagine that that's probably a lot better for resource usage, performance, and so on your computer. To have this activate, like generally it's something like AutoFS start or something like that is the way that you actually start it. But of course on Slackware, you may as well use the init system that exists. And there is an rc.autofs file in /etc/rc.d as in delta daemon. So you could do, if you want this to be active, then you do a sudo chmod plus x /etc/rc.autofs, and then that'll start every time that you start your computer, and AutoFS would be running. Whether or not you need it, of course, is really up to you. Like if you're not dealing with a bunch of networked systems and that sort of thing, then this probably isn't something that you actually need to have active. I certainly don't, and so I don't have it running, but that's an option. It is there. There's a startup script. Use it if you need it. All right, next up is Biff Plus. COMSAT. That's actually the name of the package. Biff plus sign COMSAT. This is a notification system for incoming messages. Well, Biff, I should say, is the incoming notification, is the notification system. Biff, the little application Biff, which you can turn on with Biff space Y. That means Biff is now active. Biff was named for Heidi Stettner's dog, apparently. I don't know who that is, but probably a developer at Berkeley. Her dog, I guess, barked when the mailman came around, and so the other developers within Berkeley called this application that would, you know, effectively bark. I mean, not really bark, but it would notify you of an incoming email. They called it Biff. COMSAT is the server process that receives a report of incoming mail. Now, that all with all of that said, I don't know that Biff or COMSAT work with, for instance, Alpine or Mutt. And I could be wrong, but I have tried a bunch of different things to get notifications, at least with Mutt, when an email comes in, and I just can't get it right. I just cannot get that thing to notify me. And it's really annoying. And I know that there's got to be something that I'm missing. I'm positive that there's some automated way. There are lots of different ways that I can imagine, but I kind of want the right way, and I can't find it. And I've never seen Biff in action. I don't think that Biff and COMSAT are monitoring the same thing that I would need, you know, the thing that I need them to monitor in order to get a notification of email. And I think part of that probably is that with Alpine and Mutt, I mean, I'm using them. That's not like the internal mailing system of my Linux box, right? I'm logging into some server somewhere and pulling down messages, and that's not going through like var, spool, whatever. It's going through a completely different sort of internalized system, and so maybe that's not triggering COMSAT, which of course in turn, if COMSAT isn't being triggered, then Biff isn't alerted to make a sound or to show me the message, actually. And apparently Biff is really quite annoying anyway, to be honest. Apparently it is it spits out, like it takes over or it messes up your terminal session. Like it's, you know, you could be in the middle of a command and you get an email and you'll suddenly be interrupted by the output of a bunch of, you know, of an incoming email. It seems a little bit archaic. I would imagine that you would really prefer COMSAT and Biff to just send a message to your system notification subsystem and just have it pop up in the right corner or you know, wherever you've got your notifications set to pop up so that you see that you have a message, or maybe make a chime or something like that. But it sounds to me like this just like old school, like wall or those messaging programs, they just spit stuff into your terminal, whether you want it there or not. And that brings us to bind, B-I-N-D. And bind, I mean, volumes have been written about bind. There are some really significant commands provided by the bind package, including dig, nslookup, host, things like that. So we may as well just wait to talk about bind until next episode and go through each command, really. And that means this is the end of this episode. So thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you next week.